their secret mountain lair somewhere in Colorado. This is the Image Doctors Photography Podcast with your hosts, Jason Odell and Rick Walker.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Image Doctors Photography Podcast. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And once again, we're here to talk about what we did over the weekend. So in the world of photography, our exciting
what we did on our summer vacation.
Yes, what we did on our summer vacation, as you can, as I'm sure you guys are all just out there, you know, living your lives vicariously through us.
Hopefully not.
No, I know. Yeah, that would be sad. But anyway.
But we did do some fun shooting this week.
We got out. Yes, we made up for our trip last year that we tried to do and got skunked on because of things being shut down. We didn't even realize. So what we had intended to do last year is almost every summer we go up and spend a night and go up to the summit of Mount Evans, Colorado, which is... Isn't it the highest paved highway in the continental U.S. at least?
I think so.
If not even more.
Yeah, it's a little bit higher than Pikes Peak, which most people are familiar with. And this one is just outside Denver, not very far.
Yeah, it's very close to Denver. The
town of Idaho Springs, which is where we stayed.
Yeah, and it works out, and you can drive all the way to the top. It's about, I think the summit is just over 14,100 something feet. It's just a little higher than Pikes Peak.
So it's a bit above that.
I can take a look at my picture there. It's 14,130 feet.
We weren't at the exact summit, just to be clear.
Right. Well, that was at the parking
higher
lot.
Than that.
Yeah. It was at the parking lot.
Yeah.
So, but the road will take you all the way up there and you can hike the rest of the way if that's something that you're into. But didn't convert that into meters.
So the very top of Mount Evans is 14,265.
Okay.
So we were close to it. We were doing a lot of our shooting, which we'll talk about in a little bit, you know, just a matter of a few hundred feet down from that.
And for those keeping score in the rest of the world that is not Imperial units, that parking lot area was 4,300 meters. So
it's high.
You're up there pretty good, yes. And we went up there last year only to find out the road was closed because they just didn't want to deal with the COVID stuff. So, okay, we made do. But this year we were able to get back. And normally we go up there looking for wildlife because while there are, I mean, and you could get up there really early for sunrise. We chose not to because
I've done it in the past and it can be very pretty. It's a nice spot.
It's a very nice drive up. It's not the most harrowing roads. It's paved. There's a few little curves that are, you know, no guardrails, but no white knuckle driving really, which makes it nice. It's quite accessible for just about any vehicle. People bike up that road. It's crazy. Not me. Anyhow, but we go looking for wildlife mostly. And usually there's good populations of mountain goats. Sometimes there's bighorn sheep, although those have been a little bit scarce lately. Marmots, pikas, little birds, whatever's up there at the high alpine, because you're pretty much operating above the tree line for most of that entire time. So that's, you know, you're up there at 12,000 feet or more. So what did we? So this year we didn't really see that many mountain goats. It was weird.
No, we just to expand our success rate. We shot up there in the evening and then the following morning. And then the evening, as we were driving up, just scouting things out, we did see one mother and a baby, but they were not in a good spot to photograph. We couldn't pull over. And we thought, well, we always see, you know, a big herd in an easy spot to photograph them. And so we kept on going. Turned out those were the only mountain goats we could see the whole time.
It's strange that we didn't see them this year. I don't know if they're patterns got shifted around because the mountain was closed last year and there were fewer people giving handouts to goats, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, seems like a good theory.
It's a possible thing. But as we were coming back down, we stopped and just wandered around and we ran into some pika. And pika are little, they're lagomorphs. They're related to rabbits. They're like rodents, but not exactly rodents. So they're related like to rabbits.
Little round-eared rabbits.
Yeah, little things.
That look a little bit like hamsters at times too.
Mm-hmm. Think chinchilla almost.
Yeah, that's
kinda,
a good
kind of chinchilla shaped. They're little round boys, and. Yep. I have seen pika plenty of times, usually scurrying back under a rock because I'm trying to get my camera out. We actually ran into a cooperative group that allowed us to get pretty close to them, which was cool.
And close for the most part, you know, it's like animals have zones of comfort, and it's kind of interesting finding them. You'll get up closer, a little bit closer, and then all of a sudden, go bing. And it'll usually be at a fairly consistent distance for a certain animal. And it seemed like it was, you know, what, 15 to 20 feet for the pikas, 5 meters.
Which is actually pretty close for them. But because
it is.
They're so small, we went with the longer rig. We went more with the 500 millimeter focal length.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was using 500 millimeters and sometimes enabling the DX crop on my Z7 II,
mm-hmm.
Just to get that, you know, because makes the there's going to be a lot
a little bit easier to see.
Yeah. Now the challenge with that sort of thing, small animals in the rocks down there, they move quickly,
really quickly.
Yeah, really, really challenging. And probably the hardest thing is just getting it in the viewfinder.
Very true, because you know you could say, well, wouldn't it have been better to have a teleconverter on also? And
right.
Gosh, it was hard just at 500 millimeters to find them in the frame at times.
Right, right.
And then again, they move so quickly.
Yeah.
You know, just incredibly fast.
So finding it in the frame, much less focusing on it, very, very challenging. And we brought monopods, and then we ended up not using the monopods. We just shot handheld. Which is very easy to do these days with stabilized lenses, but you still need to keep your shutter speed up pretty high.
Yeah, and it's not just something related to the lens focal length. That's also a matter of how twitchy the animals are,
mm-hmm.
right?
Well,
so
yeah,
I was trying to keep the shutter speed at 1/1000th of a second or higher if I could.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's almost as much of a shutter as a camera shake issue as much of a subject motion. You always have to think about your subject. And sometimes you'll just get sharper shots with a higher shutter speed. And to our listeners, don't be afraid of using higher shutter speeds. If your ISO goes up a little bit, who cares? I mean, honestly.
Yeah, it's not a big deal. I was shooting with the pikas, I shot a fair number at 1600 just because the light level was a little bit lower and that enabled me to keep the shutter speed up. And they were fine.
I was getting up there.
They were fine.
Because with stopping down as the conditions got a little darker, I was up around 4000 ISO in some cases. And you know what?
Mm-hmm.
They look fine. You can clean them up just easily enough. So I mean, it's just, you know, we've talked about this in the past, and it's something that I reinforce like on my birding and wildlife workshops that I've done in the past, which is I would rather have a sharp photo where the motion is stopped, you know, where I get things in not only in focus but sharp, because you can have all the focus in the world, but if the subject is moving, especially if you're panning, forget it, like things blur, right? You're going to get that. I'd rather have a sharp shot with a little noise in it that I can clean up than a wonderful, smooth, noise-free image of a blurry bird, you know, or a blurry
pike. Completely agree.
I mean,
completely agree.
There's so much, you know, this is one of those, you know, outdated, so, you know, we've talked in the past about, you know, outdated advice. And there's so many people who were just told never use auto ISO. Don't do it. Don't do it. You'll get too much noise. Not if you're using a camera made in the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
Straight up.
And then the thing that you said is the more important thing. You know, a shot where the subject moves a lot and is destroyed is a lousy shot. You're never going to be able to do anything with it.
Right.
Have a little bit more noise in there, but stop the motion. It can be a great image at many different sizes. You know, print, online is never a problem.
Right. Yeah.
Now, both of us went to the same kind of autofocus pattern
right.
independently of each other. And I think especially in retrospect, it was a very good idea. I mean, we've done this kind of thing before, but it's what can be called expanded or dynamic area mode. And do you want to just talk about what that is?
Yeah, this is what Nikon would call dynamic autofocus. And it's a little bit confusing when you see it in the viewfinder because it looks like you've got a group pattern. You know, you get, depending on your camera, you might get 9 or 20 or even 50 points of focus areas. But the reality of it is that it behaves initially like single point focus. It really is the centermost point in your pattern that is the active focus point. The camera then evaluates data from the other surrounding points. And if suddenly the subject distance changes drastically, it will use information from one of the other points to keep focus on your subject. That's the idea. So this is very good for not just moving subjects. It's not really about moving subjects. It's about subjects where you have a harder time keeping a single point on your subject. I mean, I think about single point. You want to put it on the eye of that little tiny pica, but then that pica twitches and it moves. The next thing you know, that single point is on the rock behind the pica.
Or, you know, you're shooting at longer focal lengths like we were, and it's just hard because of the longer focal length to keep it right in exactly the right spot. So this just gives you a little bit of a grace area, if I'm going to coin a term, a little bit of movement that you can have without messing up your focus. And it worked great. You know, VR or image stabilization can move things around a little bit too. And so this helps with that. So it's got multiple benefits, but it's simultaneously precise while giving you a little bit of leeway. And right. So I think that was a good choice. It worked very, very well. And I think both of us got very nice hit rates in our images.
Oh,
in terms of sharpness.
Well over 80% for some of our stuff. The Pica is not so much. I had about a 50% keeper rate with my Picas. But then the next day we went back up again looking for goats. Didn't find goats, but we found an incredibly cooperative marmot, which we both love marmots. I mean, and marmots are rodents. They're big old things.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's yellow-bellied marmots up here in the Rockies, Marmota. Yep. Liviventris.
I'll trust you on the Latin name.
Yeah, it's all good. That just goes in your keyword file somewhere. But they're nice, big. You know, they're related to groundhogs and woodchucks and whatnot. But they're bigger, and they're all up above tree line. I mean, we were shooting them. I looked at my GPS data, and it was 13,885 feet or something mm-hmm. like that. So you know, we're up there. So again, you know, well up over. You know, up over however many, what was that, 4,200 meters, you know, give or take. So up there. And one was just very cooperative. A lot of times they'll scurry under rocks. We found one that was just didn't have any care that morning, and we got pretty close with it. So in fact, I got out of the car and I had the 500 and I said, you know what, I'm too close. I had to back up. So I went to the 300 PF, the 300 F4, which is a nice little handheld lens. And I was actually able to stop down quite a bit. I was shooting not wide open because I wanted a little extra depth of field. And it just worked mm-hmm. beautifully. Got some nice shots. And as I'm sure you did too. I mean, it was,
yep.
But this yep, was
and
definitely
I shot at range. Shorter focal lengths at times as well with the marmots.
And
marmots are easier.
Yeah. Well, they're easier if they're cooperative, but we've still seen plenty where you get out of the car and they bail.
Oh, sure.
But we had a couple that we could photograph, and that made it worthwhile. It was interesting. We didn't bring it up, but our conditions were a little bit, I wouldn't say challenging, but it would have been really tough had we been there for landscapes, because the fires going on right now are blowing smoke into Colorado like you wouldn't believe. So it was hazy.
Yep, fine for wildlife at short distances, not good for landscapes.
Yeah, lots of smoke in the air. I'm hoping that clears out soon, because we'll be going up to South Dakota next weekend for a workshop up there, and hoping for that. But when you have hazy skies and smoke and stuff like that, it actually makes softer light, and that can help for wildlife. So it's not, you just have to be adaptable. You have to adapt. Yeah.
Now let's talk a little bit about what we did with our resulting shots, because despite having lenses up to 500 millimeters in focal length, pikas are pretty small, even when you're really close. So we were cropping quite a bit in our post-processing.
I agree. Cropping a bit, and that's where you start to find slight, that motion where it's just slightly soft, because your just focus system can't keep up. The focus doesn't know the difference between the head end of the pika and the tail end of the pika. I've got lovely blurry shots of them jumping or leaping across the frame, just because they were so fast.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I find when I'm processing wildlife images, I like to dial down the contrast settings a bit. And
neutral.
Open up the shadows. I go with a more of a neutral type of setting, in my camera profile in Lightroom, my profile setting. That tends to help. And then I put the contrast and color back where I want it to be. Because I find that sometimes the shadows just get too blocked up in the animals itself.
And most cameras offer a neutral setting. Those are often reflected, like you were saying, in Lightroom color profiles. But if those don't exist, you can always use the Adobe Neutral one or something analogous to it in other programs. But yeah. I completely agree with you. I think the images just look more natural and nice if you go down to that neutral setting and then tweak the contrast potentially locally or maybe a little globally, but not as much as you get with the more standard profiles. Those are just a little bit too intense for these subjects.
Now, those neutral profiles will be a little less saturated. So I find myself going back in and adding color as well.
Sure.
Especially in the backgrounds where I want to bump up, the out of focus, the green or the blue sky or whatever it might be. The other thing I was doing too was playing around with the texture slider locally. To bring out, you can use the texture slider in Lightroom as a sharpening tool. So you've got your sharpening settings in the detail panel, but you can also increase texture, which gives you essentially slightly larger radius sharpening, which can be nice for fur or feathers, as long as you don't overdo it. It's better than clarity.
Plus analog for our Capture One users would be to use the structure slider there. It's not precisely the same, but it's pretty close and fills the same kind of role.
Absolutely. So did that. Now one thing
with the pikas, I was cropping a lot.
Yeah.
Just a lot, because we weren't always able to get as close with some of them as we could with others. Every animal has a little bit different zone. And so one of the things I was playing a little bit with was either using the Adobe Super Res and Lightroom feature to double the linear dimensions of the image, or gigapixel, which does an analogous thing. It's not as integrated, but it has a few more options in terms of resizing. And that was helpful because, even though we were starting with 45 megapixels, sometimes when you crop down to these smaller animals, you end up with very few, megapixels.
Like 12.
or a lot less
or whatever. Yeah,
I had some that were less than that that I was able to kind of rescue.
I had I did not use any of the up-resing stuff, but admittedly I haven't really gone through all of my shots to process them this week. But I did run into one shot that I wanted to try something on, and I showed that with you earlier. And there was a shot of the pika where it had kind of turned its head and it was carrying a flower. It was foraging for, I don't know if they were eating this stuff. They might've been eating, but it was bringing it back to its little burrow, wherever that was. It was pretty cool to watch. It had a nice little yellow alpine flower in its mouth. And it wasn't a bad shot, but the head was a little soft. It was just, you know, it was one of those ones that was really borderline. And in fact, it was a shot that, had I been on a workshop, I would have called it an aspirational photo. The one that aspires to be good, but dang it, the focus was just off and there's nothing you're going to do to this to resurrect it, right? So I deliberately saved it. I would, rather than just throw it out when I did my first, you know, culling pass to look through, I kept it. And what I did was I decided I would try the Topaz Sharpen AI product on it, that software that we talked about briefly. And so I ran it into there and did some automatic things, and oh my gosh, it was amazing. Like, it actually made this photo completely viable, and I was frankly pretty surprised. Just because
it's pretty cool in what it can do
when it
at
works.
Times.
Yeah, when it works. I mean, we've talked about you have to be careful about sometimes introducing artifacts with these AI programs because they're not perfect. But when they do work, it was. I mean, like I said, I'm pretty astonished about how good that worked. So, you know, a thumbs up for that one. You know, I wouldn't want to shoot that way. I wouldn't want to say, oh gosh, you know, I don't have to be in focus because I'm just going to allow my software to try to fix things later. That's never what you want to do.
No.
But it does allow you to rethink your tolerance when you're going through your photos on the initial pass. And if there's something that's just a little bit softer than you'd like, not out of focus per se, but just a little soft because of whatever reason, you know, maybe the focus was, you know, on the nose and not the eye, you know, maybe it missed a little bit, especially for things like birds, you know, it might allow you to recover some shots that you wouldn't otherwise use. So
and
I'm
you
keeping
can
that
potentially...
in the back of my head.
And you can potentially blend an image that you did with Topaz Sharpen with one that with the same image done normally, and just paint in the area that you want sharpened to, and
I
that can be a way to avoid some artifacts.
I think it has a masking option too, but I prefer using Photoshop to do that kind of stuff. I just find it tools to be easier. But yeah, you're right. You could absolutely do that and just sharpen where you want to, so you don't generate artifacts everywhere else. Mask it out.
Now I mentioned resizing, and ironically, I was doing it on an image of a pika, you know, with the same vegetation in its mouth. I didn't get the flower that you did though, so that was you got. That turned out a little bit nicer, but it was one that was very tightly cropped, and I wanted it to end up a little bit bigger, and so I played with both the Super Res feature and Gigapixel, and in this case, the Super Res did better. Maybe I could have dialed in the Gigapixel if I'd spent time, but you know, just doing it quickly and easily, the Super Res worked better for that shot. But a different one, it could have been the other way around. Sometimes you just have to experiment and try. Again,
right.
Especially with the AI based ones, you just don't know until you try them.
Right.
It's worth trying a couple if you have both available.
But I am rethinking my approach to stuff. And here's where it comes in handy. It becomes an interesting discussion when you start talking about teleconverters, especially teleconverters that are more than 1.4x. You know, you always get a little bit of image degradation, and the trade-off with a teleconverter is always this issue. If you shoot them wide open, they're not as sharp as if you definitely need to stop them down, even if the focus is accurate. Because the focus tends to be accurate with mirrorless cameras. You know, it's something to explore, but it's not usually a focus problem. It's just a contrast and detail problem that you lose a little bit when you move to the 1.7 or certainly the 2x converters, even the good ones. I mean, this is just what happens. Mm-hmm. You know, and some of this is certainly a product of the lens you use it on, and this is not a teleconverter thing, but I mean, you have to start with a good lens first. I mean, if you put a teleconverter on a crummy zoom lens, it's just not going to give you the results that you like. But, you know, even then, the whole idea when you're shooting wildlife is to shoot these faster shutter speeds. And if you put a 2x converter on an F4 lens, well, now you're at F8, but that's wide open. And so you start to stop down and you're at F11 or so. Now you're losing a lot of light and that's going to increase your noise. You know, you got to use a higher ISO. So I need to explore this more, but for shots where, you know, where I might be reluctant to use a teleconverter because of the conditions, this product may be, you know, these types of products may be things that start to recover enough detail, because it's not like they're badly out of focus or super soft. They're just not as good as without the teleconverter.
Right.
You know? So it's the kind of contrast and edge acuity that you might be able to recover. I have to experiment. I'll have to see. But I have a feeling it opens up possibilities for using things. And why is that important? Because something like a 300 F4 with a 1.7 converter on it becomes a 500 that you could walk around with all day and hand hold.
Right.
And it's, you know, and whereas my 500 F, you know, lens is outstanding, it's still bigger than that other rig. And that can impact what you're doing when you're having to pack your lens on a plane or, you know, walk around on a high, you know, you want to be portable, you want to be mobile. So anyway,
I think the important thing there is,
I have.
I think it's important if you think you might need that equivalent focal length, mm-hmm. you know, either through a teleconverter or by cropping into a tighter area, do a little bit of experimentation. You know, I mean, you know, one of the things I've found in the past is if you're just doing static subjects and you're using a very good lens and a very good teleconverter, that combo can be a bit sharper than cropping in, and you don't have the noise coming
right.
up. However, you know, the things that you were talking about, light loss and things like that, I mean, that can sometimes make a difference. And then if the lens isn't absolutely the best, you can get a lot of loss from a teleconverter. So it just comes down to individual combinations.
Yeah.
And I think it's smart to know, you know, what is likely to work better for you in a certain situation.
Yeah,
and you may want to go back and forth between those options.
There's a definite... You know, you do take a performance hit with any teleconverter, not just quality of image, but also autofocus performance takes a hit. You know, all of a sudden you're not able to do things. And it's one thing when you're in bright conditions, but another thing altogether when you're in sort of dark conditions, and you can get focus hunting and all kinds of things that just don't work.
And just to reiterate one other thing, but thinking about it in the teleconverter realm, we were having a hard time finding the pike is in the viewfinder
yeah.
at 500 millimeters. If we had had a teleconverter on there too, we would have been screwed, right? It would have been just too hard.
Yeah,
well, I mean, and we would have missed them.
Well, and I was effectively doing that because by putting my camera into crop mode, I was effectively shooting at 750.
Yeah, I ended up not doing that,
but then again, I was also looking around a lot. I'm like, wait, there it is. It's not in my wait. Where's it? And you have to find which rock is your landmark. Yes, exactly. There's a lot of that that happens. It's probably the hardest thing about using super telephoto lenses, aside from getting them stabilized properly, is getting your subject in the viewfinder, and that takes a lot of practice. So, you know,
it can be nice to shoot, you know, a zoom. In those cases, but I'll just say with pikas, you don't have enough time to zoom out, find it, and then zoom back in. It's long gone.
Well, We'll put some photos from our trip up on our Facebook page so people can laugh at them or whatever.
Yeah, we did have fun.
But we had a good time. And we will be back in a week with updates from whatever it is we do this week. And so you can continue your vicarious journey of photography through the Image Doctors. But until next time, happy shooting.
All right. Bye-bye.